And this is KPCW. You're listening to the local news hour. KPCW news time is 8:06. Let's find out what's in store for our weather this weekend. Here with a report is Cedric Haynes of the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your Friday Wasatch Back forecast as we get ready for the end of the work week heading into the weekend. Your Friday will feature a mixture of sun and clouds. We will see a chance of a few more isolated showers and thunderstorms developing this afternoon. Park City will see those high temperatures climbing into the mid to upper 80s, and we'll see those highs into the lower 90s for us in the Heber Valley as we go throughout today. Now, as we go into the weekend, yeah, it's all about the increasing rain chances. Now, Saturday, we're looking at more of the same. Partly cloudy skies, a chance of a few isolated showers and storms in the afternoon. Highs will be into the upper 80s for us on our Saturday in Park City, with highs in the low to mid 90s for us in the Heber Valley. But as we get towards your Sunday, that's when that monsoon pattern really starts to ramp up across the region, and we're looking at a good chance of showers and thunderstorms. In fact, they'll likely become more widespread across the area during the afternoon hours on your Sunday. Because of that, high temperatures will only be in the low 80s in Park City for your Sunday. We're looking at highs in the mid to upper 80s in the Heber Valley. As we head into next week, look for daily chances of scattered showers and thunderstorms. So for your Monday, showers and thunderstorms look likely. High temperatures in Park City only in the upper 70s for highs, with highs only in the low 80s for us in the Heber Valley. I think showers and thunderstorms remain likely as we go into your Tuesday. High temperatures only in the mid to upper 70s for us in Park City, with highs right around 80 degrees for the Heber Valley. By Wednesday, oh, you guessed it, more showers and thunderstorms likely across the area. This is great news for the drought situation and for just the wildfires that we seem to have popping up across the area. High temperatures by next Wednesday will only be in the low 70s in Park City, with highs only in the mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley. And by the time we get into your Thursday, we're just going to keep that pattern rolling. A good chance of those showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs in the low 70s in Park City, with highs in the mid to upper 70s for the Heber Valley. So get ready for a wetter and cooler pattern heading into the end of August. As we look at your latest forecast from ABC 4 Forecast Center, I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, I'm going to be speaking with Beulah Fire Public Information Officer Aaron Hansick with an update on what's going on with the fire. Then Vaughn Robinson will come from the Park City Municipal Golf Course, will stop by with an update on this year's season. We'll then speak with Brian Friedman about his journey from the U.S. ski team to professional musicianship. We'll finish our hour by speaking with KPCW Development Director Sarah Irvin about tonight's Back Alley Bash. KPCW is kicking off the summer pledge drive season with the annual Back Alley Bash Friday. KPCW's Christine Weller has the details.
The KPCW and Cole Sport Back Alley Bash is a Park City summer tradition that stretches back almost 40 years. KPCW Development Director Sarah Irvin said it was the brainchild of Gary and Jana Cole sometime in the 80s, though no one remembers exactly when it started.
It's certainly grown over the years, outgrew the back alley there at Cole Sport, and has moved locations to where we now are in City Park. And it's a way of us celebrating the end of summer and thanking our locals for their support for this station and for the community at large.
The free event is at City Park Friday from 5 to 9 p.m. Locals can set up lawn chairs and blankets, bring a picnic, and enjoy live music from local bands Free Dog and Silver King Rocking Company. The bash also features games, face painting, balloon twisting, and more. New this year, the Corn Dog Cove food truck will be parked nearby with corn dogs and sweet treats for purchase. KPCW will also have limited edition swag for sale.
There's a lot of locals around town who have old Back Alley Bash t-shirts that Cole Sport and KPCW used to have at the event decades ago. And so for our 40th-ish anniversary of the bash, we're introducing new t-shirts.
In years past, the Back Alley Bash marked the end of successful KPCW summer pledge drives. This year, the bash is kicking off the nonprofit radio station summer fundraising season. Irvin said KPCW's goal is to raise $350,000. That money covers daily operations, including on-air news programs and online offerings. The station is also facing a new funding challenge this year. After Congress cut $1.1 billion in previously allocated funds, NPR, PBS, and their roughly 1,500 member stations across the U.S., including KPCW, lost all federal support. KPCW now faces a cash shortfall of $264,000, about 15% of its operating budget, for fiscal years 2026 and 2027.
Thanks to this community, we raised over $150,000 in July during what was essentially an emergency fundraising call. We're incredibly grateful for that. We still have another $115,000 to raise to completely cover that shortfall.
KBCW's on-air fundraiser is September 8th through 11th, but donations up until September 14th count toward the summer pledge drive. Christine Weller, KBCW News.
After two decades of open space conservation, a Snyderville Basin committee is shuttering for now. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports it's run out of money.
Most of the trails and much of the open space in the Snyderville Basin, except for the Swanner Preserve, owe their creation to a series of bonds issued by the Snyderville Basin Recreation District over the past 20 years. Voters approved the first bond in 2004. 1 year earlier, Summit County had established the Snyderville Basin Open Space Advisory Committee, or BOSAC, which would give residents a voice in how the money would be spent. BOSAC has helped purchase the Willow Creek Park area, the open space under Utah Olympic Park, Toll Canyon, and areas around Summit Park. The county and Basin Rec spent the last of its West Side open space bond money in 2022 on a property along the Union Pacific Rail Trail. And according to a county staff report, Basin Rec has, quote, no near-term planned intent to issue more. So August 13th, the county disbanded BOSAC. County leaders could revive it, though, if the basin approves more bond money in the future. BOSAC is not in charge of distributing the more recent $50 million countywide open space bond voters approved in 2021. That responsibility sits with OSAC, or the Summit County Open Space Advisory Committee. The county council also made administrative changes to OSAC August 13th, including changing its bylaws so members serve staggered terms. Summit County and Basin Rec are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Utah's looking to continue adding to its sporting events roster and has most recently set its sights on the Winter X Games. KPCW's Christine Weller reports Governor Spencer Cox is in talks with the X Games CEO.
Governor Cox said during his monthly PBS Utah News conference Thursday, the Beehive State is always looking to attract more sporting events.
That's something we're in favor of. It's good for the economy. It's good for our people. It's good for our athletes. And we have a lot of X Games athletes that live and train in Utah, and we want to be supportive of them as well.
A year after it was announced the 2034 Winter Olympics would be in Salt Lake City, the Summer X Games and the Red Bull Soapbox Race made their Utah debuts in June. Park City Chamber President and CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff also previously said the city is courting the Winter X Games, and Cox said the state would love to see more X Games events. He said that would be part of a phone conversation he set with X Games CEO Jeremy Bloom Thursday afternoon.
We would love to see more of that happening here. And that's certainly going to be part of the conversation, is just to see what, you know, what the future looks like for the X Games, what their numbers look like here.
The Colorado mountain town of Aspen has hosted the Winter X Games for over two decades, but doesn't have a long-term contract with the Action Sports Organization. Its current contract expires after the 2026 Winter X Games in January. X Games is currently working on expanding, aiming to introduce a new global, team-based format with year-round competitions in 2026. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Chris Conaby replaces Parkite Tom Jacobson on the seven-member Department of Alcoholic Beverage Services Commission. He was appointed by Governor Spencer Cox and confirmed by the Utah Senate unanimously Wednesday.
This is no different, I think, than the national parks, right? You have to preserve the asset, which in this case is our culture and our history and our safety, and then you have to take that and put it in the limelight of people being able to go to the park and experience it. And that's a difficult job, and I think this is a difficult job as well. I do think we've done a great job as a state of balancing that.
That was Conaby at the Senate Business and Labor Confirmation Committee August 18th. He told KPCW afterward the analogy came to him while cutting his lawn.
When I was done cutting the lawn, I had a Coors Light because I felt like it was a great analogy.
It was his answer to the question, do you drink? Traditionally posed to new DABS officials. A Silver Springs resident, Conaby is a principal at real estate firm Utah Development and Construction, which has spearheaded improvements at Utah Olympic Park. He served on the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission from December 2020 until November 2024. Conaby's resume also includes short stints as interim director of the Utah Inland Port Authority and chair of the Point of the Mountain Development Commission, originally created to redevelop the former Utah State Prison site in Draper. Before that, he ran corporate recruitment for the state of Utah's Economic Development Office under former Governor Gary Herbert. Former DABS Executive Director Tiffany Clayson vouched for Conaby's diversity of experience.
Not only of government, of economic development, but also of tourism, hospitality, and experience from the commercial or business end. I think that perspective will come in handy as he works with his colleagues on the commission to make really difficult decisions in who receives a license or not. And also when the commission is working as it's duty bound to, evaluating, you know, folks that receive violations, what those penalties should be as a result of violation.
Clayson has since been replaced by Erica Evans, also confirmed Wednesday after Clayson departed for the private sector June 27th. Evans is a social drinker who previously served in Utah's Office of Legislative Research and General Counsel, where she drafted alcohol bills. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Part of the McLeod Creek Trail will be closed Saturday for the Arts Council of Park City and Summit County's annual Art on the Trails event. The Saturday exhibition will feature performance and visual art from local and regional artists along the trail near the Copper Moose Farm Stand. Tours leave every 20 minutes, starting at 2 p.m. The final tour is at 4 p.m. Tickets are required, and the Arts Council recommends buying in advance. Kids 12 and under are free. There will also be free live music at the Copper Moose Farm Stand from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Well, the Beulah wildfire continues to burn in Summit County. Here with a status update is PIO Aaron Hansen. Good morning, Aaron. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with helping listeners sort of place where this is happening. Where exactly is the fire located?
Yeah, so the Beulah fire is burning on the north slope of the Uinta Mountains within the High Uintas Wilderness, which is part of the Uintas Wasatch Cache National Forest. It's approximately 7.5 miles southeast of the Bear River Ranger Station along Highway 150 or Mirror Lake Drive.
Okay, so if I wanted, not that you could do this, but if I wanted to drive to it, how would I get there from Park City just in terms of helping people place it?
From Park City, you would head probably more north towards Evanston, mm-hmm. Wyoming, and connect with 150 off of Highway 80, and okay. You would take one.
So how many acres are... How many acres are currently being burned?
Yeah, currently we're at 5,637 acres as of last night.
Okay, and put this in some context. Is that sounds like a pretty substantial wildfire for this area, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Okay, so whenever we're talking about wildfires, we hear these terms, like one is how much is contained and one is how much is complete. First of all, can you explain what the two terms mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Containment refers more to the percentage of the fire perimeter that's been secured with a fire line. And that's typically directly on the active fire's edge. But we on the Beulah Fire are using the term completion due to the location, terrain, and topography of this fire. We are speaking more to the amount of work that's been done by crews on the ground. This takes into account four different objectives, which include full suppression efforts, you know, confinement strategies, point protection, or, you know, protection of structures or values at risk, and then also staff or crews here who are doing monitoring efforts as well. So due just to the remoteness of this fire and the inability for fire crews to be directly on the fire's edge, we are reporting more in terms of completion and the work that's been done on the ground.
Okay, so let me understand this a little bit better. Right now, what's the percentage of completion that you're reporting?
We are at 48% complete.
And that means that of the work you intend to do to contain this fire, you're about half done. Is that basically it?
Yeah.
Okay. And when, you get to 100%, we're done and we get to go home?
Hopefully. That's okay. The hope, but...
Okay, so that's interesting. Now, why do you think that other fires use the other terminology?
Again, you know, it's all very specific to the fire. So a lot of times fire crews in the initial attack stage can get right on the fire's edge and create burnout operations or attack the fire head on. And they start creating hand lines directly along the edge, which then they can refer to it as containing the fire, which you see a lot of wildfires is, you know, it's percent contained. But then you get some of these remote fires that are in wilderness areas where it's just unsafe to put firefighters directly on the fire's edge and to build those hand lines safely. And so a lot of work goes into securing perimeter a little further out from the fire where it's safe to put fire crews, and that uses a lot of like natural barriers, so like roadways or rivers, things like that. Also, hand crews and heavy equipment, and it kind of just boxes the fire in. So if the fire were to start running or spreading quickly, these barriers and lines are in place to hopefully hold that fire. And that just, it's the safety of the fire crews. It's strategic in a way that, you know, we're not putting people into these really dense vegetated areas that are just really hard to access.
Now, you mentioned obviously the concern of the safety of the firefighters is a pretty vital concern. How many firefighters have been deployed?
Right now, personnel on the fire is 617, and I believe around 500 roughly are firefighters.
And where do they come from? I mean, it's not like you've got a standing army of 500 people, you know, sitting in a locker room somewhere in the Uintas.
No, not at all. I mean, they come from all over. They're on assignments all fire season. And so a lot of times they'll come off of another assignment and they'll come to, you know, this fire. So we have crews from all over the nation.
Okay. So
of course there's a lot of
go ahead.
Resources as well, but I was just saying we have a lot of local resources as well to this area, but there's also quite a few that come from other states.
Now, obviously, a substantial number of personnel. Are there other kinds of resources that are deployed in addition to personnel? What other kinds of equipment do you have out there fighting the fire?
Yeah, so we're using a lot of heavy equipment on this fire just to help clear and secure roadways. So, like, the North Slope Road is a very prominent line that we've been working on this entire fire so far, and that's using a lot of heavy equipment and crews. And then we are also using hand crews, which are building lines and helping to protect structures and do hose lays. And then we're utilizing aviation resources for things like water drops, monitoring flights, and transporting some of our crews to spike camps all within the fire perimeter.
Do you have any idea how this fire started?
No, that's still under investigation, and I don't believe that'll be determined for a while.
Okay. And then it's typical that takes a while to figure out, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of have to wait for the fire to stop burning over that area in order for investigators to get in there and really have an idea.
Now, have there been evacuation orders associated with this fire?
Yeah, so there was one evacuation order in place right at the start. They evacuated the Hinckley Boy Scout camp, which was approximately 3 miles from the fire. But other than that, there hasn't been any other evacuation orders.
Okay. And so I take it at the moment there aren't any significant risks to populated areas that you're seeing from this fire?
No, not right now. The fire is pretty slow moving right now due to the cloud cover and the precipitation that we've been getting. It's kind of been in and out of active fire activity. There's always potential risks to populated areas should dry weather come back and this fire decides to run. So we've been doing a lot of structure protection and readiness messaging for areas like Christmas Meadows. There's a couple other populated areas to the northwest and northeast of the fire. So we've just been working to prepare those areas should this fire grow or expand towards those areas.
Okay. And if listeners want to stay current on the fire, what's the best place for them to get their information?
So public information officers is part of Team 4, Great Basin Team 4. We've been providing updates twice a day on the Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest Facebook page, as well as the Utah Fire Facebook page. And listeners can always go to the INSEWeb webpage for verified up-to-date information, which is also updated twice a day. And that's INSEWeb is INCIWEB.wildfire.gov.
Okay, Erin, anything else you want to share with our listeners before we go?
Oh, nope, that's it. Thank you so much for having me on today.
And thanks so much for joining us. Heber City's plans for downtown zoning changes are going to take a little bit longer. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports leaders are still nailing down specifics like building heights and green space requirements.
Community Development Director Tony Kohler says creating the Central Heber Overlay Zone, or CHOZ, has been in the works since 2021 when the city adopted a new general plan. The goal of the proposed zone is to promote a more vibrant downtown by making it easier for property owners to create infill density and allowing more types of mixed-use development. Heber City Council members discussed the latest draft of the proposed zoning changes at their meeting August 19th, and they had a lot of questions. For infill housing, such as accessory dwelling units built on the same lot as an existing home, the city is considering whether to allow only long-term rentals. Mayor Heidi Franco asked how the city would enforce such restrictions.
If the city says you've got to have a minimum one-year lease period in your apartments or your houses in this area and somebody doesn't do it, what's the penalty? This is going to cause you a lot more paperwork.
She also asked whether the plans could require more green space downtown. Councilmember Mike Johnston, meanwhile, shared his feedback about the types of development that best match Heber's downtown. He said he'd prefer townhomes or mansion-style apartments, which look like a large single-family home, to duplexes.
When I see duplexes and twin homes, I see a suburban type of home with two big garages and sprawling out, and that really is not old town. It's not historic.
You. The city's planning staff will use the council's comments to revise the zone proposal. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, we're going to get a chance to tee it up with Park City Municipal Golf manager, director, head pro. Which of your many titles do you prefer? Vaughn Robinson.
My title is golf manager.
Wow. Okay. With golf manager Vaughn Robinson. Morning, Vaughn. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
So, Vaughn, let's start with an overview of the season. Tell us a little bit. How heavily has the golf course been used this year, and have you seen any changes from prior years?
Actually, you know, we got open April 17th, so 2 weeks earlier than probably the last 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. So trends are up. We're about 2,100 rounds up this season. Part of that's being open 2 weeks earlier, but yeah, it's been hopping.
So 2,100, how many total rounds did you have last year approximately?
I think 33,600 roughly last year, 18 whole rounds.
I'm just, you know, doing the math in my head and thinking about how many days you're open. That how many rounds per day is that? Something like?
A little over 300. 300 probably on an average.
Wow. And that's, what are your hours? How early can people tee off?
So first tee time, 6:51 a.m., and the last tee times usually around 6:45, and then we do a twilight program at 7.
And do you even count those as part of that round?
Yes.
Okay, so wow. And the twilight program's still there?
It's still there, going strong.
Always been very popular. Okay, there were some pricing changes this year, and a little bit of controversy about that. How have those worked out? Have you seen any changes in who's playing as a result of those pricing changes?
It's settled at the moment. I really don't see a lot of changes in who's there. Faces mm-hmm. are very familiar. Anything that truly gets affected, I would think more would be Salt Lake play. They may not come up as frequently, but that's easily going to be filled with a resident or a visitor in town.
Because the price changes for the non-residents, it was pretty marginal, wasn't it? How much was it? Like $5?
$20 for a non-resident, okay. Which realistically, when they're coming from out of state, still quite a bit cheaper than what they're accustomed to paying.
Okay. So it's been really dry. How is that? What kind of challenges has that presented to the grounds crew?
Obviously, Tony could answer that better, but making sure that our watering is spot on, checking those measures. They do go out there. We've been able to put a wetting agent on the green to help to where we don't need to water as much and, you know, minimize that percentage that goes down every night. And they've done a pretty good job on that.
Of course, it's holding up pretty well, notwithstanding all this dryness.
Definitely, we get lots of comments of how great the golf course is from folks that play, so we're very proud of that.
And one question I meant to ask you before when we were talking about pricing changes. The season pass for residents, was that was brought back this year?
That was brought back.
And how popular was it? How many did you sell?
We sold 59 season passes to residents. Mm-hmm. That does include the grandfathered ones from before. Mm-hmm. And then we sold 66 junior passes this year, where last year I think we sold 34. Mm-hmm. So quite a bit of an increase.
And are those getting heavily used? Can you tell?
Yeah, you see, there's going to be a percentage of them that get used very heavily. There's going to be a percentage of them that really doesn't change their behavior from last year. It's far more convenient for them, and they show up about the same.
Now, you mentioned that you sold a bunch of junior passes. Talk to us a little bit about sort of what you do as a golf course to facilitate learning and participation by young people.
So for the youth, we have two junior programs right when they get out of school, usually those first couple weeks in June, usually around 56 to 58 kids. Both of them were full this year. Then we also have a teen camp that first week that the kids are out of school. And I believe we had 28 kids this year. And the most we've ever had before was about 24. So very good participation in that. Then we also have a Monday program for the kids, usually age 7 to 17. And I think we had 103 kids sign up this year. They go from 2 o'clock until about 6:30 every Monday afternoon during the summer. Last week was their club championship.
Yeah. Okay, and do you still have, in the past, I know from time to time the high school would bring kids out as part of phys ed programs. Do you still have any relationship like that, or is that gone?
There's not a lot of that happens. We do, the MARC does a program in 4 weeks in basically the end of June through July that they send their kids over for day camps that get taught. And the high school team practices and plays there as well.
And do you also have sort of, if parents want to sort of get their kid introduced to golf but don't want to engage in a organized program, do you also have lesson opportunities for kids?
Yes, we have 4 or 5 instructors that will definitely be available to teach some lessons to youth.
Okay. It's the end of August. Any sense of how much longer you're going to be able to stay open?
We usually make it until November
after Halloween.
5th or 7th.
Yeah.
Mother Nature takes over, obviously. We're getting in that time where I think the last I heard, we're going to lose 70 minutes of sunlight in the month of August. So you start getting shorter daylight, start getting cooler temps and some frost. And, you know, a lot of those folks that visit in town for that 1 to 3 months start going home. Yeah. But we start condensing available tee times as well, so we do still stay busy as far as that goes.
Now, I heard rumors that we're going to get some updates to the golf carts.
The plan is new golf carts next spring. It was approved on the budget. Right now, the golf carts, we're starting to see a little bit of that battery dying and stuff. The cooler temps definitely bring on that. So that is a plan for sure at the moment.
What is the life of a golf cart fleet? I mean, how long do you hope they're going to last, and how long has this batch been in
service? Most of the battery life is warranted for 3 years when you get it. We try to go 4 to 5. This will be 4.5 years on this current fleet. And realistically, you could go in and change all the batteries, but then it becomes more aesthetic. You know, how it's the steering get bent and crooked? How's the wear and tear on the underneath?
As much as these get used, I imagine 4 or 5 years is probably a long enough lifetime. Now, the new golf carts, are they going to have any fun toys like GPS or anything like that?
We're still out there on that. Mm-hmm. We thought about it. We had it in plans, and then we cut it out. I think we're trying to trim some fat across the city, and that would be an initial one. The golf course is very well marked with all the sprinkler heads, yardage markers, and stuff like that. Everybody has the range finders.
Everybody has a telephone, too, right?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of apps.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are some expectations of people to see it. So we'll address it again before we do the carts. But
is it a significant cost in terms of, like, rough, what as a percentage of a golf cart price? Is it like another 5% or something?
So it's about $45,000 a year to lease the equipment to have the GPS.
Yes. Okay. So it's a significant expense.
It is.
Okay. My understanding is that there is a consultant study being done. Tell us about why you did that, and when do you expect to hear the results?
So a couple reasons. One, it's always nice to kind of look at operations, make sure everything's being efficient. What improvements can be made? Is the pricing structure good? Is staffing up to par, so to speak? The other option that we're looking at is, how's our capital equipment? You know, how's the replacement on the mowers? Do we have what we need? Do we need to replace something now versus pushing it and replacing it later? And then capital improvements of the golf course. How is the condition of the golf course? Can we create some areas that don't need as much watering? Can we create new tee boxes? Should we adjust some greens? So they're kind of taking a full look at everything at the golf course and come back with some recommendations, especially about that course improvement.
You know, from time to time, I know private golf courses will basically shut down for a year to do a complete remodel. Is that something that's ever happened here, and is that something that you ever anticipate happening?
We'll see where we go. We do need a new irrigation system. There's a couple options of doing that, whether you shut down the whole golf course, whether you shut down 9 holes, whether you play through it. it's more of a view, I guess, on how to do that versus do you want to still have golf available? If you did 9 holes at a time, you'd still have 9 holes. The majority of our golf is accustomed to 18-hole rounds up here. So it would affect people a little more on that, but you can also play through it, but you may end up skipping a hole.
Okay.
So every day, Monday through Friday.
And when do you think that will, you know, when do you think you're going to have to deal with that? Will that be something that happens as a result of this consultant reports?
They'll give us a better recommendation, but 3 to 6 years is probably a fair assessment at the moment. But yeah, we'll love to hear what their thoughts are on that.
All right, Vaughn, anything else you want to share with our listeners before we go?
No, I think just come visit us. The golf course is there. Just a friendly reminder, tee times can be made online 9 days in advance at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time, 7 days in advance over the telephone.
All right. Vaughn Robinson, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Great. Thank you.
The Summit County Council did not repeal the ordinance that approved Dakota Pacific's controversial development Wednesday. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports a pending court case looms over the decision.
August 14th, Dakota Pacific Real Estate withdrew its application, asking the Summit County Council to approve a 725-unit neighborhood and public-private partnership at Kimball Junction. The Salt Lake City developer is poised to build it anyway, since a new state law required the county to approve it through a separate process. That approval happened in July, so the firm no longer needs the permission it got from the council last December. Dakota Pacific never signed that agreement, and the county ordinance approving the Kimball Junction project was then challenged by thousands of residents who signed a referendum petition. When the county clerk invalidated about half the signatures, keeping the December ordinance off this November's ballot, the residents took her to court. A hearing had been set for August 19th in 3rd District Court, but a judge has reset it for the following week. August 20th, the council discussed repealing the ordinance the referendum originally sought to repeal.
If we leave the ordinance in place with the application withdrawn, it's kind of an orphaned ordinance.
But Councilmember Roger Armstrong shares his colleagues' concerns about optics and whether repealing the ordinance would influence the court case over the referendum petition signatures. One of County Clerk Eve Furse's arguments defending her decision to reject some of the petition signatures is that the issue is moot or irrelevant because the new state law supersedes the county's. Summit County Deputy Civil Attorney Dave Thomas says repealing the ordinance might help the clerk's case since the thing the referendum is about wouldn't exist anymore. That gave Armstrong pause because he says there's a perception that the county has tried to thwart the citizen referendum. Councilmember Chris Robinson agreed a repeal should wait until after the hearing on August 26th. For ethical and practical reasons, the county attorney's office says courts might decline to rule on issues that are moot or irrelevant. Robinson and Armstrong don't want to intentionally moot the dispute over whether the clerk's reasoning was correct.
Because of the controversy surrounding the signature gathering, I'd like to give as much opportunity for the court to weigh in on that.
First denied 30 of the referendum's 77 signature packets, primarily because some or all of them were unbound and rebound before being submitted to her office. She's claimed the law is black and white on that issue, while the referendum supporters maintain she's misinterpreting the law. Even if the court rules on who interpreted the law correctly, Robinson says it might not matter if state lawmakers change the law next year. They indicated they would at an interim session hearing last month after hearing complaints from the Summit County residents who organized the referendum. Council Vice Chair Candace Hart summed up the debate.
What I'm hearing is that there's an intention, at least by a portion of the council, to try to let this have its day in court just to get some sort of ruling or clarification, you know, on the bindings and so that it's clearer going forward. And then there's sort of the pragmatic side of, you know, stopping spending money and repealing the ordinance because the application's already been withdrawn. So we're kind of balancing these two things.
Speaking to legislators at the state capitol last month, Summit County Republican Party data analyst Jimmy May called it Orwellian, how taxpayers are having to pay the clerk's attorneys who are arguing against the taxpayers' referendum. County Attorney Margaret Olson pushed back August 20th.
We're the defendant, not the plaintiff.
Both.
We're defending a court action. We're not prosecuting a court action. So it's ultimately not our decision whether or not we spend taxpayer money on legal fees, because we are the ones being sued.
There was some concern about waiting too long to repeal, having to print ballots with the referendum on them, and then having to reprint them to remove it, which would also cost more money, but it didn't carry the day. The council ultimately voted 4-1 not to repeal the original Dakota Pacific ordinance. The county says no residents have appealed Dakota Pacific's second approval, which can't be challenged by a referendum. Proponents of the referendum have advocated for a constitutional challenge to the law that allowed it. Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Brian Friedman once sought to find his way to podiums as an alpine skier. Now he gets to go on stage routinely as a professional musician. His band Free Dog will be featured at tonight's Back Alley Bash. Good morning, Brian, and thanks for joining us.
Buenos dias.
Okay, and Sarah Irvin is also here because we're going to be talking about tonight's Back Alley Bash.
Hey, good morning, Roger.
Brian, tell me a little bit about your journey. Talk a little bit about your background and your career as a ski racer.
We're going deep.
We're going deep.
I grew up here in Park City and, came up through the ranks here and eventually, dreams started coming true and made the national team and raced World Cup for 10 years and... it's a pretty dangerous sport. A number of injuries kind of ended my career early and opened up a whole new realm with music simultaneously. So
now yeah. What events did you participate in as a racer?
I was a downhiller, downhill and super G on the World Cup, but, made the team in slalom actually. So it was kind of like, eventually more and more just bled over to the speed side.
Now, I find it interesting that you said you ended your career early after 10 years. That doesn't sound like, isn't that a pretty decent length career for a ski racer?
Half of that was in rehab, rehabbing from two ACL reconstructions and a pretty massive, tib-fib fracture. So really, I say 10 years, but that was in, I was on the sidelines.
So did you go through the typical Park City progression, sort of, skiing with the Park City ski team? Did you go to the winter school?
Yeah. The whole thing. I went to Parley's Park Elementary, Treasure Mountain Middle School. I went to the high school for a year and then winter sports school.
So your career ends. Was music always an important part of your life?
That's an interesting question. I think it always meant something to me. I remember at a very young age, the first time I heard a Bruce Springsteen song, I was probably 5 or 6 years old, and I was obsessed. I just wanted to hear that song over and over again.
Which song was it?
I don't remember. I honestly don't even remember the name of the song. I just remember it was Bruce. It was his voice, It was very distinct, and God, I wish I could remember the actual song. I was young, and then I'd ask my folks to get me these, remember those commercials you'd see back in the day, these infomercials, buy the three, box set of this 50s, 60s, and 70s hits. And I begged my folks for one of those, and they got me one of those. And it was all these tapes. And I don't know, I was just always into it, right? And then started playing guitar and then, writing songs. And my roommate in college started the band of Heathens out of Austin, Texas. So he early on kind of got me onto singer-songwriter stuff, more country, folk, Americana, and that was it. Put down my electric guitar and picked up the acoustic. And yeah.
And when did you pick up the guitar?
It was probably the first time, 15 years old, 16 years old, something like that. A good friend of mine, my best friend growing up, his mom was a musician. She's like, hey, I got this classical guitar if you want to play it. And Pam gave it to me, and so I strummed this, gut string nylon guitar, and that was it. That's how it started, and then kind of evolved from there.
Now, was that something that you pursued while you were professionally ski racing? Were you the guy who took the guitar in the back of the bus?
I was that guy. Yeah. It's you have a choice, right? You can play video games. You can watch German television because we were in Europe all season. I'm gonna play guitar, and it was fun. It was more of to pass time and make fun of people, and I'd write songs about the crazy stuff that was going on at the time, whatever we were up to. It's just, having fun.
Okay, so your ski career ends. What year did you basically retire from the circuit?
2009.
And in 2009, did you go get a real big boy job before you sort of turned to music, or did sort of segue right into it?
No. I'm not much of a, I don't like authority, so. no big boy. I've had one big boy job my entire life, and it lasted about 9 months. But yeah, right after skiing, I was playing music full time for about a year, and then I was like, oh man, like this is hard, kind of gnarly. Like I don't know if I can just go back to like living out of a van. You know, like we were doing ski racing, it was felt very similar. Just musical equipment was traded for, you know, ski equipment. I mean, it was fun. Don't get me wrong. I just like, wow, this is a lot to take in. So I, you know, said I just. Why don't I start a bamboo ski pole company, you know? So I started a business mm-hmm. and started manufacturing bamboo ski poles here in Park City. And that lasted, we actually just finally sold that a year ago. It wasn't like a big boy job or anything. It was more of like lifestyle, and music was always a part of that.
So let's talk about how you make that move. Okay, so you're done with ski racing. You say, I want to be a musician. How do you start that process of trying to make some money at it?
Oh man, nowadays it's a lot easier.
Really?
I would say, yeah. I mean, the barrier to entry is lower, right? Like you don't have to write your own songs. I mean, that's the crazy part about it. I mean, that's the sad part about it too, is like you can just go on ChatGPT and say, write me a love song. But like back then it was just friends pushed me towards it. I had a group of friends that, you know, they were looking out for me, and they were musicians, and they said, hey, you know, you've got some cool songs here, let's record them. And we made a record, and now this was like 2000, probably six. And, you know, making a record back then and doing all this marketing stuff and having a website was harder to do. And I had all these things, I put it all together and was like, you know, somewhat professional. And it started getting, you know, asks and offers to play shows, and played around town quite a bit. It was there were quite a few bands back then in town, local bands playing Main Street. It was a little more of a live music scene than it is now.
It's less now, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, venues got to, you know, do what they got to do, and a lot of it's DJ stuff. So, but there's still plenty of, you know, obviously Mountain Town Music's doing a great job at supporting that. And so there was a lot going on, and eventually, we got picked up by, I think the craziest part was like, I walked on to an airplane boarding and I was like, oh, that's Spring Cleaning. Holy, how'd that get on there? And we started getting some radio play and like satellite radio, and it was pretty cool. Yeah.
Okay. So let's take a little bit more of a step at a time. So yeah. Do you start playing clubs? Is this the vagabond regional musician life where you play bars and go from place to place sort of in your van? Is that how it starts?
Yeah, it kind of starts like that. You're like picking in, you're like playing wherever you kind of can
right.
Honestly, like trying to like, you're playing at coffee shops, you're playing at random, you know, parties, you're playing just at, you know, campfires with your friends, and like seriously, and you just want to play. You want to share what you've written. You have all this emotion to kind of, you know, give to people.
And today, tell us a little bit about how your life works in terms of, you know, touring and recording.
We don't like do proper tours, like we've got a, you know, 3 months on the road kind mm-hmm. of thing. We're very like systematic and surgical, like we'll rip up to Jackson or Sun Valley or, you know, the stuff around here or California, but, you know, not like long tours. So studio stuff, I write all the music typically, so if I feel like I'm inspired and I have a bunch of songs that are good enough, then okay, let's go figure out, like, what are we going to do? Who's going to produce it? Where are we going to do it? Fortunately, I've mentioned my friend Gordy, who started the band of Heathens. They have a killer studio in Austin, Texas. And the beauty of that is you have access to all those musicians down there, too.
Sure.
So in the past, I've done that. But now, you know, this is like since Free Dog really got started, that's what I've been doing. But now with the crew that we've been playing with, who we'll be playing with tonight, the Back Alley Bash, you know, we've been coming pretty tight over the last few years, so it's going to be a little different, you know, recording with them versus picking and choosing musicians out of, a hotbed like Austin.
So you're now in a real band in the sense that you've got the same group around you. Tell us about the pieces in the band, and tell us if somebody was going to generalize a genre to try to characterize your music, inaccurate as that might be, what would they say?
Yeah, we're kind of agnostic to genre, but, you know, I would say, like, psychedelic rock with, some Americana and folk tendencies and some pop tendencies. So yeah, we like to
How
play.
How many pieces?
Oh, it's a 5-piece band. Yeah, two guitars, bass, keys, drums. all great local guys, all guys that love to ski, bike. It's a good groove right now, really good groove.
It sort of sounds like a pretty fun existence. If you can make a living playing with people that you like and still get in the skiing and the biking, there's something right about that life, isn't there?
Yeah. I get asked that question a lot. It's not the most lucrative lifestyle, but it is rewarding, you know, I'm pretty stoked to be able to have the opportunity and the people want to listen. It's awesome. It's really that's what it's about.
Okay. So we're looking forward to hearing you tonight at the Back Alley Bash. Sarah, let's do some of the basics. What's going on tonight?
So tonight is the annual Back Alley Bash. It's the 40th-ish annual Back Alley Bash.
What's up with that?
I know, right? Well, no, nobody can quite remember when it started. We've been asking Jana and Adam and the team over at Cool Sport. Sometime in the early 80s is what we're gathering. Do you know, Brian?
I don't. No.
We're hoping that maybe someone has photographic evidence of the very first bash and we can date stamp it.
It wasn't called the Back Alley Bash back then.
It was just in the back alley of Cole Sport, right? A barbecue with burgers and some music and fundraising for KPCW.
So crawling through the park record archives might not even give us the answer.
Exactly. But if someone out there knows the exact date, we'll take it. But for now, we're calling it 40th-ish.
But wait, if you have the exact date, do we promise them some swag? Can we?
Well, that's the fun thing. Tonight, we're going to have limited edition swag. We were talking to Adam and Dude and a bunch of the guys that have been around forever with the Bash, and they were mentioning that, you know, there's a lot of T-shirts floating around town from some of the earlier bashes, and so we're bringing back kind of a retro vibe, limited edition Back Alley Bash T-shirt. Brian, we'll get you one.
Nice. I like the retro
Brian,
vibe.
Do you have any old ones? Do you have any old ones in your closet? Anyway.
I've purged pretty well over the years, so no,
Marie
I don't.
Marie Kondo'd your closet, but we'll get you one tonight. But those will be on sale as a benefit to KPCW. We are in our summer pledge drive fundraising cycle, so you'll be hearing us more and more reminding folks to donate to this station. But tonight's really all about community. The Bash is a way to celebrate, you know, everything that makes summer in Park City so awesome. And it's a free concert. Come on down to City Park. We will have a food truck this year, which is new in the last couple of years, but we also encourage people. This is a BYO event. We're permitted for, everyone can bring their own picnic, bring your own coolers, bring your own picnic blankets and chairs. And it's on rain or shine. I think
looks pretty good.
Yeah, I think we're in great shape. A little sprinkle here and there today might be nice, but
bring it on.
The bash is on starting at 5 p.m. Free Dog's taking the stage, and then afterwards there'll be a little break in the set right around 6:30, and then Silver King Rocking Co., which is Dana Williams and Dude, their band is going to hit the stage right around 7:15. So great music all night long. We're so stoked that Free Dog will be there early. It's a kid-friendly event, too. We'll have kids' activities, face painting, balloon tying. So bring the whole family.
Okay, so there's construction going on
at
City Park. So the usual... we urge you to carpool sort of gets emphasized tonight because there really aren't going to be very many parking spaces.
It's true.
What are the options? Can you park at the resort tonight? Can you park at the high school?
We would definitely want to encourage people to take public transportation.
I think there's a home football game tonight.
There is a home football game tonight.
High school is not a good
idea. High school's off limits. Home football game. If you can carpool, if you can ride your bike, that's perfect. Take the bus in. It's right there at City Park. You'll get dropped right off and walk on over.
Do we know whether the resort is an option?
I don't know.
We will look into it.
Sure.
It's usually a good option.
It's usually a good option, and the bus does stop there.
Well, and also the library parking lot and walk on over. And so this is a Park City event at City Park. We want to thank Summit County Rap Grant through the Arts and Culture Rap Program for helping support this free event, and also Mountain Town Music for helping make the sound awesome. Brian and his whole team are working with us, and we're so grateful for that.
Now, we mentioned there will be a food truck. If there's only one food truck at all these people,
exactly.
A word to the wise is, as good and as efficient as they may be, you're going to have a tendency to have some lines and,
bring some snacks. And also Claire Wiley and John Burdick will be out there doing a live broadcast from the City Park lawn. So stop on by, check out the merch, come, you can chat with folks on air if you want to say a quick shout out. Like I said, we'll be there starting at 5 p.m. So we really encourage folks to come on down and enjoy this fun community event.
And I know you're not going to resist the temptation to talk a little bit about the upcoming pledge drive before we go.
I mean, I wouldn't be a development officer if I didn't remind people that they can donate to KPCW now to help us reach our summer pledge drive goals. We'll have a donation station available tonight. You can hop online anytime at kpcw.org and make a donation. But we are in our fundraising cycle. The on-air pledge drive kicks off on Monday, September 8th, when we'll have dozens of community partners coming on to help us fundraise. But we're, you know, this is a opportunity for us to remind folks that we are here in the community as your local community station, keeping you connected, keeping you entertained, and we hope you support us.
Sarah Irvin, Brian Freeman, thanks for being. We'll all see you tonight.
See you soon.